Here we go. Hey, everyone. Welcome to the Weekly Space Hangout for Friday, March 25th, 2016. I'm Fraser Cain, publisher of Universe Today. This week, we're going to be talking about early flash of an exploding star, ancient polar ice, and the tilt of the Earth's moon, supermassive stars, Virgin Galactic, and when Saturn's inner moons formed. But, of course, we've got a special guest as well. So, joining us this week, we've got Brian Koberline. Brian!
Hi!
Wow.
I'm finally back.
What is the break that you're on?
I'm on spring break, so I have this week only, and then I'm back on my teaching schedule at this time.
That is awesome. We've got Kimberly Cartier. Hey, Kimberly.
Hey, Fraser. Hello, viewers.
You're somewhere, some kind of...
I am in Cleveland right now, so this is my temporary office space.
We got Morgan Renberg. Hey, Morgan.
Hey, everyone.
Gone for a week, but now you're back after getting Congress to expand the planetary science.
We can only hope.
We can only hope. And we've got very special guest this week. We've got Andrew Helton. Hey, Andrew.
Hey, everybody. Thanks for having me on.
And we've got Ryan Hamilton. Hey, Ryan. And now you can see Ryan's got some kind of hardware in the background. Ryan, where are
Hello,
you?
Hello, everybody.
And then, therefore, who are you and what do you do?
So I'm in Palmdale, California. This is where NASA's SOFIA's telescope is based out of. It's a 747 with a big, giant telescope in the rear. And this is one of the instruments that's going to be flying on SOFIA in just about 3 weeks. It's called Hawk Plus. The high angular wide field camera upgrade or something like that. I actually always forget. High resolution airborne wideband camera. I should know that, but I always forget.
And you actually said before we started that just go around the corner through a door there, there's the actual 747 right there.
Oh, yeah.
Like right like down.
Yeah, I'll try to move slow so it's not just nauseating. But... here's the door to the lab, and then we open it up.
How?
And there she is. That's Sophia right there.
Yes.
Get my head out of it. So you can see this is the door where people just come in the hangar. The telescope's actually looks out towards that way. This is a big, nice, big hangar building. There's some other aircraft over there. That's the DC-8 that you can see. And past that is ER-2s. It's basically U-2 spy planes that have been repurposed for Earth reconnaissance and observations. So, yeah, there's Sophia.
This is about the coolest thing I think we've ever had on the Weekly Space Hangout. This is just awesome. Andrew, so for people who sort of don't know you, can you give yourself an introduction and then we'll learn more about about Sophia?
Sure. I'm a staff scientist at SOFIA, and right now I'm sitting at the NASA Ames Research Center in the Bay Area in California. This is where the Science Mission Operations is located for the SOFIA program, and Ryan then is sitting at the Armstrong Flight Research Center, which is in Southern California near L.A., where the aircraft is, of course, housed, and that's where the operations occur from. That's where all the flights take place. So here we're doing the science operations side of things.
Right, and so for people who aren't familiar with SOFIA, I mean, can you give just an explanation of what you have done to the 747 and why?
Sure. So SOFIA is one in a long sort of lineage of aircraft on which we've housed telescopes of various sorts. The main idea is that we're trying to observe in the infrared portion of the spectrum, which is absorbed quite efficiently from water vapor in the atmosphere, water vapor, ozone, a number of other molecules in our own Earth's atmosphere. And so in order to be able to observe in the infrared, it really helps to get above that water vapor and to get as high as possible, preferably into the stratosphere where the water vapor content drops precipitously. And so if you can get into the stratosphere, you get above the water vapor and the atmosphere becomes more transparent. And the advantage of doing this over space is that it's much cheaper than going to space. And you have a ground-based platform, so you can work on instrumentation, you can swap instruments, you can improve the technology without an expensive program to take the shuttle to the observatory, like a Hubble servicing mission. The first observatory was just in a Learjet. It was a very small, I don't remember exactly what the size was, about 18, 20 inches, something like that, pretty small. And that was in the 70s. And then after that, they had the Kuiper Airborne Observatory, and that operated through the 90s. So it had a nice long lifetime. And then this was the latest in that tradition. It's a 2.5-meter telescope, and it's mounted in the side of a 747 SP. The SP stands for Special Performance, and it was one of about, I think, 40 or 50 of these specially crafted 747s that were designed for long-haul flights. This was before, it was built in the 70s, so this was before the time when they had the high-efficiency jet turbine engines, and so they had to decrease the weight in order to get long flight times out of these aircraft. So they would shorten the fuselage significantly, so it's much shorter than a normal 747, and then that allowed them, of course, to, 17-plus hour flight times. So in order to mount the telescope, then they would cut a large hole into the side of the fuselage, and that was a really long, complex engineering process to do that, and it was done by L3 in Waco, Texas. And the hole in the side of the aircraft is about the size of a garage door, so you could drive a truck through the hole through which the telescope is observing. And then there's a pressurized bulkhead that separates the cavity in which the telescope sits from the rest of the main cabin, where all the crew are actively working throughout the flight. And that pressurized bulkhead is designed to withstand the pressure pushing out from the pressurized cabin, and it amounts to about 250,000 pounds of pressure on that bulkhead once we're at altitude. Then the telescope is mounted on a spherical bearing in that bulkhead and is free floating, so it can move with the motion of the telescope so that it's inertially stabilized in flight to keep you on target. And so those are some of the engineering challenges they had to deal with Sophia.
So, Ryan, I'd love to sort of talk about what happens, leading up to and actually doing a mission, because, how much flight time do you have? How do people get there, get your instruments on board? How long does the loadout happen? So I'd love to hear sort of leading up to and actually performing a mission. That was very nebulous.
So the observatory works every other... no, it's okay. The observatory has observing cycles. Usually they're timed to be around a year, just like Hubble and other opposed to use the telescope and use the instruments that we have here at the observatory. Then it goes kind of into a big pot. Everything gets mixed around, and they try to find optimal suit. They try to group things together, and hopefully the time of year is right for the objects that they want to look at. So it becomes a very, very complicated process to schedule everything appropriately. Since the telescope only points out one side of the aircraft, if we want to look at something else in the sky, we physically have to turn the plane. So we end up with crazy crisscross open and, or not open, we take off and land at the same place, but we end up with very complicated polygons and crisscrossing flight patterns, which are very hard to deal with just because there's different restricted airspaces in the U.S. There's some military bases that we have to fly around and avoid, and also the airspace just off of the LA coast is very, very busy. So we have to basically thread a needle to get up and into the LA corridor to land here in Palmdale. Loading an instrument on the observatory takes about 2 days. All the big stuff happens in a day, but cabling and checkout processes and various things usually extend it out to 2 days. But it's a very kind of hair-raising experience because there's the big garage door that the telescope is in, but there's no other doors in the aircraft. It's just standard passenger doors. So all of the instruments have to fit through a standard passenger door on the side of the aircraft. So it's a very, very thin thing that we have to put these giant instruments in through. So it's a very long process. It can take a little bit of time to get it all right. The plane flies for about 10 hours. We usually get about 7.5 to 8.5 hours, depending on the scheduling and the efficiency of what's going on. It takes us about a half hour to take off, a half hour to land, and then there's a half hour of setting up the telescope and making sure it knows where it is in the sky once we get started. It's pretty amazing to see in flight. The telescope is stabilized with respect to what we're looking at, so whenever there's turbulence, you can see if you're looking at the back end of the telescope where the instrument's mounted, it does kind of jiggle up and down and bounce and kind of bob and weave, but it's actually staying fixed with respect to the source that we're looking at. If you want to look at it in the other reference frame, the plane is pivoting around the instrument in order to keep it steady. So it's pretty impressive to see in action. It's an amazing feat of engineering, at least, if nothing else.
Andrew, so, you know, it's a infrared observatory, and so I'd like to talk a bit about sort of like what are the kinds of targets that you're most wanting to observe with that? What's it really specialized in?
Sure. So I actually support a mid-infrared instrument on board, Sophia. It's called the Forecast instrument. And that instrument is designed to observe in what we call the thermal infrared. So this is about 5 to 40 microns in wavelength. And at those wavelengths, what you're really looking at is warm dust and gas in the universe. And so that instrument in particular tends to focus on observations of star-forming regions or massive stars, stellar explosions, all different stages of the stellar life cycle. But we also tend to focus on a lot of planetary science as well. So we've done a number of observations to observe comets and asteroids in our own solar system as well. Pretty much anything that is in that thermal infrared portion of the spectrum. But in terms of the entire instrument suite, we actually have capabilities ranging from the optical almost down to the UV through about 240 microns. The optical observations are oftentimes used in exoplanet studies where they're actually looking at exoplanet transits, and they're doing that at high cadence. So they're taking images a few times a second. And then we're also using those instruments to observe occultation events. For example, in 2011 and again in 2015, we were able to observe the occultation of a background star by the small body Pluto as it passed in front of it in order to learn about the atmosphere of Pluto. And I believe Ryan was on both of those flights.
Yep.
And then when we go out to longer wavelengths, then we're targeting oftentimes a lot of molecules. So, for example, there are recent observations of a young star where we were able to observe water vapor in that star to identify the structure of the infall region as that star, as the cloud surrounding that star is collapsing to form that newborn object.
Ryan, so that sounds great. You were sort of participating in doing some occultations with Pluto, I guess, in concert with what was happening with New Horizons?
Yeah, it was kind of crazy how well the event ended up being timed. It happened just before, I think it was 2 or 3 weeks just before New Horizons' closest approach, and this was an occultation of the brightest star Pluto had ever occulted, and it happened to be exactly or almost exactly over Christchurch, New Zealand, which was where Sophia was on its southern deployment. So it was just a really kind of amazing alignment of everything to make it all work out in terms of timing. And it's a very hair-raising and very complex timing of things because we were trying to get in the exact center point of where Pluto's shadow was moving across the Earth. If we were at that exact basically geometric center of the shadow, Pluto's atmosphere acts as a lens on that background's light star. And in the very center of the occultation, the light that we're seeing, instead of kind of going down as Pluto goes in front of the star, it actually rises up in what's called a central flash, right in the very geometric center where Pluto's atmosphere lenses the light and enhances things and makes things temporarily very bright. And we were able to see that. You have to be very, very, very close to the center of the occultation in order to catch that. It ended up being the team from MIT who was working with us, and they were the ones driving the investigation. They literally were working out the details from observations they had gotten earlier that day, and they used a satellite phone to call from Lowell Observatory to us on the plane in the Southern Hemisphere. And it's not a very easy thing to talk on a satellite phone. It's like talking over an old 2400 baud modem. You basically, it's good for text messages and not really voice or anything. So it took a few tries to get the information to us, but we adjusted our trajectory and the flight path and we got basically right on target.
That's awesome. You know, talk a bit about the instruments. You've got the instrument that's there behind you, and saying this is sort of getting prepared for your next mission. Sort of, how many of these instruments do you have kicking around, or are new ones supplied for various experiments that people want to do?
So the observatory has, I think, 6 or 7 instruments. I'd have to count them. But they're all available for use at various times. Some of them are led by what's called principal investigators, or PIs. These are instruments that are built by a specific team for a specific purpose, and if you want to use their instrument, you have to kind of collaborate with them and work something out. So we have a few of those, but Hawk here behind me is what's called a facility instrument. So this is going to be delivered to the observatory. We're going to take over operations and maintenance of it, and we will have it available for use whenever the community proposes for it. So this was it originally started at University of Chicago. At some point, I think it was 2011 or 2012, it was selected for an upgrade, and that upgrade was a combined team of JPL and Goddard Space Flight Center. Goddard built brand new detectors that went into the system, and JPL built a polarimetry assembly. So that really lets us dig into the details of magnetic fields and dust and things like that in the far infrared, which is a tremendously unique capability for the observatory now. So we're just getting this guy ready for flight, like I said, about 3 weeks or so. We're in the lab here. We're actually mounted to a simulator of the telescope to help us figure out alignment and do basic fit checks and things like that, make sure there's no last-minute surprises. It's a long process of working in the lab here. You can see the instrument itself. You might be wondering why there's these little orange cones around. The instrument detectors, they're cooled down to 0.13 degrees Kelvin. So it's below 1 degree Kelvin. It's not easy to do that. We have to do it using what's called an adiabatic demagnetization refrigerator, or ADR. It basically uses a magnetic field, a very strong magnetic field, to the details are I won't get into it, but it you use a magnetic field to align something to that magnetic field. It's able to suck up energy in the system. As that magnetic field goes away, the energy in the system kind of randomizes the magnetic field in that working material that we have inside of it, and it like removes heat from the system, and that lets us get down to below 1 degree Kelvin. So that's while that's running, the cycle's actually running right now. It's actually a magnetic field. It's fairly strong. These are just emergency kind of safety limits of. If we were running the magnet at a very high strength, which we don't plan on doing, the barrier actually is the limit where the device can interfere with pacemakers and medical devices and things. So this is just our little safety boundary to make sure that, you know, everything's safe in the lab here, there's no problem, but this is just in case something is unexpected.
Right, if you don't want to get your phone wiped, don't get any closer.
Yeah, the joke is don't hug the cryostat while the ADR is running. You'll wipe your badge or your credit cards.
Right. Andrew, I got a question for you from Nancy Graziano, who helped set up this interview. And she wants to know, how many missions are you able to run in a year?
So that's a good question. We're still slowly ramping up to what we hope to be our our final observational cadence. And in the end, we hope to get to 110 to 150 flights a year. Right now, this year, we're shooting for 100, about 102, actually. They're divided up into a flight series where we'll take one instrument, in some cases two, if they can be co-mounted, put it on the observatory, and then fly for a few weeks at a time. And during that period, we'll generally have 3 to 4 flights per week. And then after that, there will be an instrument swap that might take a week, maybe a little bit more, before we put on the next one and then do the same thing. And so the overall cadence then is driven by science demand on individual instruments.
When you think about like the amount of flight time that you get, if you get 150 missions and you're doing observing and you're getting up above the clouds, I mean, you're getting a lot of observations done, even compared to some of the mountaintop, you know, when you think about some of the stuff in Chile or in Hawaii, you know, the amount of observing time that you're getting probably rivals them or sometimes beats them because you just, you know, you can just get so much time up there with the telescope. It's pretty impressive.
Yeah, it's quite a bit of time on the sky. It hardly rivals, you know, sites with 300 good observing nights per year. In part, we have one crew of pilots on board, and that actually is oftentimes a limit on our effective observing time during the night, especially in the winter, whenever the nights are very long. We don't necessarily have the opportunity to make full usage of that night's worth of observing, and that's not due to the aircraft itself. The aircraft could easily fly long enough to observe for 12 hours on a long winter night. The real problem is crew, and since we have one flight crew on board, they have a fixed period of time that they're allowed to fly, and they have to land within that window. And so that's really our restrictions in terms of like the individual flight efficiencies for a given night. But yeah, with 100 flights a year, I mean, we're talking 600 or 700 hours of good observing during each year, each cycle.
Now, you say that this is the sort of latest in a long lineage of airplane-based observatories. Mm-hmm. Are there plans in the future for other, you know, other observatories, larger telescopes, other platforms?
That's a really good question. I don't think there's currently any plan for the next generation after SOFIA. When we were going into the design of SOFIA, which, you know, the design process has been quite long. I mean, it's been in the works for well over a decade. When we went into that, the specifications were for an expected 20-year lifetime. And so we're hoping that that will take us at least through JWST. And then after that, I don't think there's anything else really on the table right now. In terms of, like, aircraft capabilities, a 747 is about the biggest fuselage you can get. I mean, you can get a little bit larger if you go into, like, an Airbus, one of the new Airbus, whatever it is, 380. But it's not going to get you that much more in collecting area. So it's not clear what the next step is going to be after SOFIA's lifetime.
Yeah, I'm always fascinated by these various platforms. There's the, you know, the rocket-based observatories and the balloon-based mm-hmm. observatories. And this is great. It feels like a really great balance in between them. So what's coming up sort of in the, you know, in the next little while? What's something that maybe people should be sort of keeping their eyes out and watching for news?
Oh, that's a good question. So one of the observations that is really exciting and that hopefully will be published very soon are the observations that Ryan was just talking about, where they performed the occultation observation by Pluto of that background star. There's been a lot of work being done on that data, and it looks like it's just about ready for publication, and so that'll be really exciting. Coming up. We have quite a number of really excellent observations that have been performed of the galactic center in our own Milky Way galaxy, and some of those have already been published in part by Ryan Lau and Terry Herder out of Cornell University, and they have some really exciting results about the massive black hole at the center of our Milky Way galaxy and the galactic the structure of gas and dust in a ring that's falling into that black hole. That's really fascinating. And they also have some really interesting observations of a supernova remnant that's near the galactic center that gives us some idea of the amount of dust that survives a supernova eruption. And so that's really exciting, too. And that just recently came out as well. So there's a lot that's in the works. So hopefully there will be more soon.
That all sounds fantastic. Okay, so we're just reaching the end of our time. Ryan, why don't you let people know where they can find out more if they want to sort of follow your story on the internet?
Yeah, so I have my Twitter handle in the little tag underneath of me there. I just posted some pictures from the lab. I'll be doing that in the run-up to the flight series as well, and they'll also be going out to the Sophia Twitter and Instagram and Facebook channels as well. Those are probably the best places to get up-to-date information. Usually whenever we do an instrument swap, you can find out the quickest and easiest just by looking at the Twitter, and usually there's a picture of whatever instrument is on the telescope at the time. And then the general NASA and Sophia web pages, which we can send in some way. I tried to do it in the chat, but it wouldn't let me. I'm not special enough.
Wouldn't let you post a link.
Yeah, which is understandable.
No problem. We'll put all the links in the show notes for this episode, so no problem. All those links will be there. I especially like your Instagram channel, which is one of my favorites. You got lots of great pictures of the sort of inside the flight and stuff. So it's great. There's just great photographs of the airplane and also the science work that you guys are doing. So it's all great. Mm-hmm. Well, Andrew and Ryan, thank you so much for joining us for the Weekly Space Hangout. Get back to the science. You got about a lot of prep work to do, and another successful mission. And you know, when you do discover some really interesting stuff, please come back and let us know.
Well, sounds good. Yeah, all thanks right. So much for having us.
All right, thanks a lot.
It was fun.
All right, bye.
Bye, everybody.
All right, let's move on to some of the stories that happened this week. Kimberly, tell us about the early flash of an exploding star.
Sure. So this was a very exciting thing that we learned about this week. It was observed by the Kepler Space Telescope, which most people know for its wonderful observations of thousands of extrasolar planets. And that was really what it was designed for. But in addition to observing the 150,000 odd stars in the Kepler field, it also managed to capture observations of about 500 very distant galaxies that are also aligned with the Kepler field. And it observed them with the exact same cadence that it observed exoplanets, so one observation about every 30 minutes or so. And while it was looking, they actually found two supernovae that happened in these galaxies during the primary Kepler mission. And what was truly exciting about it is that one of these supernovae that Kepler observed, they were actually able to capture the very first flash of the supernova. It's called a shock breakout, which happens right when the collapsing core of this supernova, when it shocks back outwards, when it sort of rebounds. This shock breakout is the first time we see all of that amazing supernova energy rebounding from the core, and the first time it breaks out of the outer shell of the star, and it releases an incredible amount of energy in a very short time. And these flashes occur over about 20 minutes or so, and so normally we never would be able to see this first shock of a supernova, but Kepler just happened to be looking, and because it has such a short observational cadence, we could actually observe the first flash of the supernova, and then all of the expanding supernova energy afterwards as well. But what was also very particularly interesting was I mentioned that they observed two supernovae, but they only observed one that had this shock breakout, which was interesting because we didn't really realize that these kinds of supernovae, these core collapse supernovae, could have different mechanisms. They don't all look the same when they core collapse. And that was something we'd never observed before. But I thought that was so cool. You never catch a supernova right when it's starting. And we just happened to be looking, and Kepler just happened to see it.
Like, one of the questions we always have is, like, you know, Betelgeuse or Eta Carinae, when are they going to go? Come on already, Betelgeuse.
There's no indication.
Star in the sky.
Yeah, a star will be a red supergiant for hundreds of thousands of years, and there is no warning sign when it's about to go supernova. So yeah, we don't know when Betelgeuse will happen or any of the other ones, and so we can never. It's only really serendipitous when we happen to catch it, and maybe we catch it a few days late when it's already gone through the first stages of supernova. Now we're sort of catching it on the rise of brightness, as it expands. And so this is one of the, this is I think the first one we've ever caught right as it flashed. And then we were able to observe the full from the full sequence from red supergiant through the flashing and all of the subsequent brightness and then dimming of this supernova. So it's a full supernova sequence that we were able to catch for the first time.
But with the Kepler observatories, like, did they find it in the data afterwards? Or, yeah. I mean, they didn't get any kind of alert that it was happening. It's not like it was swift, mm-hmm. where they're like, there's a supernova happening right now, quick hurry, let's take a look.
Yeah, that would have been nice. But no, they were still combing through the 4 years of primary Kepler data. And the way it was set up was that the data pipeline for Kepler was designed specifically for exoplanets, and anything else that happened to fall in there, we were able to catch. But we're still going through all of the backlog of data, and so we only just now realized that we had observed this supernova flash. And the flash occurred in 2011, and we're just now finding it. So 5 years later, there's still an amazing amount of science and data to go through from the Kepler mission.
It's interesting to think about some of the other things that Kepler can be used for. I mean, as you said, right, it was planned for planets, but this is sort of like a hint of what we might see with the Large Synoptic Survey Telescope, which we keep on and on about here, which is that there's some real value to go back and look at the same part of the sky again and again and again with a fairly rapid cadence to see things that are changing in that region.
Right, so. And usually with galaxies and the wider universe, we don't ever have a chance to observe any phenomena that happen on really short timescales, even on like a human lifetime, let alone 20 minutes. We never have the chance to do that, and so Kepler, this observation with Kepler was very serendipitous and very exciting. It can, like you said, give us a hint of what we can look forward to with LSST.
Yeah, that sounds fantastic. Okay, let's move on. Brian, let's talk about supermassive stars that aren't.
Okay, well, they are supermassive stars. This is actually ultraviolet observations of a cluster known as R136. And the largest known star that we have, is 136A1, which has a mass of about 265 solar masses, so 265 times the mass of the Sun, which is extraordinarily huge for a star. And pretty much, we're not entirely sure how stars greater than about 100 solar masses actually form. And the kind of prevailing model has been that they would form from collisions between two large stars. So two large stars merge, and it creates this very large, supermassive star. Well, this recent survey, this ultraviolet survey of 136, found 9 stars bigger than 100 solar masses in this one cluster. It's not a huge cluster. It has about 70 bright O-type stars. And so to find 9 of these large stars within a single cluster, the odds of that happening just from mergers is pretty unlikely, particularly given the fact that this cluster is only about 1.5 million years old. So there really wasn't enough time to really merge.
But couldn't these stars just form from clouds of gas that happen to have that much mass in them? I mean, there's a process that stops them from working that way.
There is. There's something called the Eddington limit. And basically, as a large quantity of gas were to collapse into a star, it would heat up. And a really large quantity of mass would heat up very quickly, and that would tend to push away any of the surrounding gas and dust. So basically, if it formed as a super large star, you would think that it would start to collapse, it would heat up really quickly, and then that outer material would get pushed away, so it couldn't collapse into the star. So how you're getting that much collapsing before it heats up, we're not sure.
So, but I mean, we just threw out all the theories on how you can get a star that big, right?
Basically,
it can't collapse under their own mass from all of the material, and you can't have two stars crash together because it's sort of statistically impossible. So how do you get that many stars with that kind of mass?
That's a good question. So
thank you.
Somewhere our understanding is not clear. We don't know how these types of stars can form. And what's interesting about this recent research is that they looked at this particular cluster, and this is one where they can see the individual stars. But they also notice that these bright stars have a particular emission line known as Lambda 1640. And they've looked at other clusters, particularly ones in nearby galaxies, and they find that same signature. And it's dominated by really large stars. So when you're finding these signatures elsewhere, it's pointing in the direction that other clusters are also containing these supermassive stars, which means, again, it points to the idea that this isn't just a fluke.
Fine. So now you can see more of them. But, you know, what is the mechanism? I mean, I recall you talking about sort of simulations of stars in the very early universe that had potentially maybe tens of thousands of times the mass of the sun, right? Some of the supernova simulations and how these big stars could form. So, I mean, could it be like what they're made out of, that, you know, if they're a more pure form of hydrogen, they can form into those bigger masses?
It could be. I think the larger question is going to be, large stars like this aren't stable over the long term. And so they reach some kind of pseudo-equilibrium, but they're not like main sequence stars that are going to go for billions of years. They're going to last for a short period of time. So there's probably something in the dynamics that allows them to form that we don't fully understand. So it's very possible that they're forming from gravitational collapse, and some mechanism that we're not familiar with is allowing them to collapse long enough to become stars.
Even like the 268, whatever it was, you know, the R1A1, that one, even 136.
265 solar masses, yeah, the R136A1.
Yeah. Even that could be that it just collapsed directly.
It's possible. I mean, I think you're going to find some stars that will form from mergers, but the fact that we're finding so many in a single cluster kind of pushes away from the idea that that's the only mechanism by which these stars can form.
How long would those kinds of stars live?
I don't know the lifetime offhand. I would probably say on the order of tens of thousands of years.
That's amazing that we're
seeing. The O-types only last about 1 million years or so.
Yeah, and the more massive they get, the quicker they're going to die. And so we happen to be seeing this huge cluster within a few tens of thousands of years of when they're all going to detonate.
Right.
That would be amazing to see them. Cool. Okay. Morgan, let's talk about Virgin Galactic.
Yeah, so a couple weeks ago I talked about how NASA was funding research into supersonic flight with the intention of reducing basically the noise and increasing the efficiency of these planes to make them more commercially viable for rapid transit of passengers across the Pacific and the Atlantic Oceans. And what we learned this week was that this isn't simply an effort being undertaken by the government. It's also being looked at by private industry. And this came about because of an agreement signed between Virgin Galactic and an aerospace company somewhat strangely named Boom. And what Boom would like to do is sell you a ticket from New York to London for a journey that would take less than 3.5 hours for just $5,000. A round-trip ticket for $5,000. And they say that you could take off, say, from London in the morning, conduct your business in New York, and return in time for dinner that night back in London. And what they need is to do a couple of improvements over the Concorde. They need to make it more fuel efficient. Fuel certainly is more expensive now than it was several decades ago. And they need to make it quieter. And in order to work on both these things, they've signed an agreement with Virgin Galactic. And we know Virgin Galactic for being the first company to want to launch commercially people into space, space tourism. And they think that Virgin Galactic can provide some of the engineering know-how that they've used when developing their reusable spacecraft for this high-performance supersonic jet. And so they're going to be working with Virgin Galactic to make use of this engineering knowledge. And in return, they're going to offer Virgin Galactic the chance to buy the first 10 jets that they produce. And this would give, if successful, give Virgin Galactic a more steady business here on the ground, point to point, rather than what can only be imagined as a relatively low-volume business launching space tourists. And this company, Boom, says they've identified 500 point-to-point routes currently served by long-haul aircraft that could instead be served much more rapidly, 2.5 times as rapidly, by their new supersonic jet.
So what kind of jet are we looking at? I mean, are we looking at something that's like the Concorde or something that's more like a Virgin Galactic, like something...
Oh, it's much more like the Concorde. And just like the Concorde, they're taking pains to make the thing as light as possible. And so it's only going to have 40 seats arranged, one on each side of an aisle, so 20 rows of two seats. And instead of having big, fancy, lie-flat, sort of first-class seats like you might take on a long-haul jet, it's much more going to be like domestic first-class, where you have a nice, comfy chair, but that's about it. And that makes it a lot lighter and therefore more fuel-efficient, also faster, and it lets them accomplish the whole thing. Carrying people sort of in the way we've always imagined carrying, or always done carrying people, but just over much longer distances that way.
So how would this then compare to what the, I mean, you mentioned sort of like it's less people on the plane, maybe not, but I mean, I've been inside a Concorde, you know, on the ground, and it's a pretty cramped experience inside there. They're not very big aircraft. So I'm just wondering from a business model standpoint, what's different today than maybe was the case 20 years ago when you could fly from Paris to New York City in 3 hours on the Concorde?
I mean, well, I think what they would say is that the Concorde operated for more than a quarter century, and in order to achieve a level of reliability and financial stability that would keep this as, you know, a profitable business, you don't need a huge improvement on a quarter century of operation. And I believe that they're saying that they'll be about 30% more efficient and about 20% quieter than the Concorde. And they're banking on the notion that that will be a sufficient increase to allow them to make a profit on these flights.
Right. I mean, I and you can look back in previous episodes of this show where I predicted the future Virgin Galactic, which is, you know, going up and coming back down is fun. You get a little bit of weightlessness, but to actually do, you know, to get some value out of your flight, you use that parabolic arc, you know, above the atmosphere, above, you know, there's no sonic booms. You just get out of the atmosphere, fly 20, you know, Mach 20, and then reappear somewhere else on the Earth and re-enter the atmosphere and land, and you can get point-to-point anywhere on Earth for, you know, within a couple of hours, which I think is, that gets really interesting. So, I mean,
I would say this
isn't looking at that as all part of the machine, right? Like, let's look at some stuff that's Concorde, let's look at some stuff that's actual point-to-point anywhere on Earth. Like, that's the future of this whole process.
Yeah, I agree, and I would see this as, you know, the first sort of small step in that direction, because, you know, it's a big enough task simply to start a new airline. It's an even larger task to start a new airline with a new sort of supersonic jet that hasn't been used successfully in decades, and it's a, you know, maybe impossible task to start an airline with a space plane. And so I think Virgin Galactic, if their true intention is to operate these sort of long duration or long distance, short duration flights, they're taking a sensible first step, and they can establish ground operations and a customer base and, you know, experience turning around high performance aircraft on a short basis far, far more rapidly than they're ever going to be able to turn around space tourism. And this may provide some form of steady income before they can to fund sort of what will be the next generation of spacecraft that would then maybe allow them to start doing these sorts of flights.
Yeah, and you know, Blue Origins is trying to get into the same game as well. So I think there's a whole new round of companies attempting this kind of thing. So it's all going to get pretty interesting.
Yeah, it's an exciting time.
Yeah. All right, let's move back to Kimberly. Let's talk about ancient polar ice revealing the tilting of Earth's moon.
Sure. So we're going back into the solar system now. And a very, very interesting discovery by a large collaboration of lunar observations that showed that the tilt of the Earth's moon has actually shifted by about 5 degrees since the time it formed. And the shift happened to occur about 3 billion years ago. So it's been pretty steady for the past 3 billion years, but about 3 billion years ago, or about 1.5 billion years after it formed, something dramatic happened that shifted the tilt of the moon's orbit by about 5 degrees, which is quite a large shift. And they were able to determine this by looking at the pattern of the ice on the Earth's moon's two poles. And this is a combination of observations from the Lunar Prospector, the Lunar Reconnaissance Orbiter, the Lunar Crater Observation Sensing Satellite, which is LCROSS, Gravity Recovery and Interior Laboratory, a bunch of different lunar observations, and they were able to age date the ice on the poles of the moon to about 3 billion years ago. But right next to it were areas where it's clear that ice used to be there, but is no longer there. And that can only happen if those areas of the moon's poles used to be in shadow and then were very suddenly thrust into sunlight, which rapidly evaporated all of the water ice from those areas. And from the pattern of the ice and the areas that ice used to be, they were able to determine that it was about 5 degree shift. And they don't know quite why the orbit shifted quite so drastically. That's a very big change, and they don't know why, but they were able to determine that something like this happened, which gives us a clue that after the moon formed, the Earth-Moon system was not quite as stable as we used to think it was. So it gives us a clue as to the changing orbital dynamics of the inner solar system at the time.
Well, they've known, or the, you know, they suspected that Mars has had fairly big tilt changes over time, and mm-hmm. maybe even the Earth. So I wonder if some kind of interaction between Earth's changing tilt, or you know, would have some kind of interaction with the Moon. I'm not sure if Morgan
I'm not sure
does.
Either.
Does this, yeah, Morgan, does this sort of fit into your wheelhouse a bit?
Can you say this? I didn't hear. It broke up on me for a second there, what the question
was.
Oh,
just sort of like what kinds of mechanisms might cause the moon to tilt over time? You know, could it be some interaction with the Earth's tilt over time, or is it just it settling down before it finally fully locked?
So neither the moon or the Earth are perfectly spherical, and neither of their orbits are perfectly round. And what this can introduce is over time, slow drifts of the orientations of these objects. In fact, we can see the moon, even today, wobbles back and forth as it orbits around the sun. And the favorite planetary science explanation for any anomalous thing would certainly be that something enormous hit it and knocked it askew, but that's probably less likely than imagining that that the moon formed in one orientation, and because it's been sort of tweaking the Earth and the Earth's been tweaking it over the course of the last few billion years, it's caused that orbit or that pole, the direction of that pole, to kind of wander around, exposing areas that would have originally formed in shadow and allowed the ice to cool there.
So Kimberly, I mean, does this mean that, you know, it may want to change the places that the scientists are looking for ice? Like, it sort of opens up new spots and vistas to look for you know, past evidence of water on the moon?
I mean, we've always known where the current ice poles are on the moon, and so we know where to look for the water ice, and we know now that there used to be ice in other parts of the moon. But I think the more significant understanding that we're gaining is the age of the ice on the moon, which can be a really interesting piece of science to understand, and then understanding how the ice used to interact with the other parts of the moon, and we can sort of see the evolution of how the lunar surface and the lunar ice have interacted over the past few billion years.
Someone is saying on the chat that the phases of the moon app needs to account for the shift. Yeah, we'll put that in. If you go back far enough, the actual tilt of the moon will have to change.
We'll have to add that in.
Yeah. Do you think that this is going on to other more objects in the solar system as well? I mean, if we find, you know, if we suspect it on Mars, we seem to find it on the Moon. I mean, does it mean that the solar system, the early solar system, was a much more dynamic place than maybe, you know, we think now?
I think definitely. I think we really don't have an understanding yet of how we've gotten to the orbital configurations that we have right now. And like Morgan said, talking too fast. The very few of the orbits in the solar system are perfectly circular. Very few of the bodies in the solar system are perfectly circular, and that introduces a lot of interesting dynamics that could still be changing the orbits of planets and moons. I mean, we just are now seeing evidence of Planet 9 based on the orbits of Kuiper Belt objects and things. We don't understand how things in our solar system are even working now. So I think going back even further can give us, I don't think we understand those orbital dynamics even at all.
Yeah, and I guess we don't have enough evidence or any evidence of exomoons yet to be able to take a look at them. So, cool. Okay, so I think we've got one last story from Morgan about more moons, and these are Saturn's inner moons and when they formed.
Yeah, this was a perfect segue because the area of physics that we've been talking about is an area known as dynamics. And dynamics is perhaps the oldest field of astrophysics, and it basically has to do with understanding the motions, the orbits of planets and stars and other objects with respect to one another. And Saturn is perhaps the most interesting laboratory for dynamics in the whole solar system because it has 62 moons, 60 of which lie outside of the rings, two of which are embedded within the rings. It has the solar system's second largest moon, perhaps the solar system's smallest moons, rings scattered throughout that whole system. And it's been a large challenge for dynamicists to try to understand how did we arrive at the configuration we have today, and how long has that configuration persisted. And what work this week has suggested is that perhaps the orbits and, in fact, the existence of many of the moons we see today might not date back to the beginning of the solar system, but rather date back just a few hundred million years. And the way they figured this out was to set up a simulation of all of the motion of the objects in the solar system, or in the Saturn system, and then to basically run time backwards. And what they found is if they ran time backwards, given our current assumptions and understandings about the motions of these objects, you would reach a situation relatively quickly that basically wasn't plausible. They would be in places doing things that they simply couldn't have been doing. And they proposed two solutions to this problem. One solution is actually that the orbits of these objects in general are changing much more slowly than perhaps we've been observing over the current period of time. The other suggestion they had was that these objects just aren't that old. And thus, sure, they've actually been moving pretty quickly for the period of time we've observed them, because you don't have to run time back 4.5 billion years, you only have to run time back a few hundred million years. And they eliminated that first option that I suggested, the idea that they've really just been evolving relatively slowly, by looking at the moon Enceladus. And we know Enceladus for its enormous geysers shooting nearly pure water out of the interior of a liquid water ocean buried beneath Enceladus. And in order to maintain an ocean like that and to generate enough heat to create geysers like we see in the extreme cold of the Saturn system, you need to generate a ton of heat. In fact, more heat than we can account for given our current understanding. That's sort of a separate problem. But in order, the one way that we know to generate a lot of heat like that is to have the orbits change quickly. And because when the orbits change quickly, the fact that there aren't spheres comes into play. And you sort of stretch and squish these objects. And you can imagine stretching and squishing a solid object, that's going to generate a lot of heat. It causes the ice, which is as hard as rock, where Saturn is, to rub back and forth on one another. And if you rub two rocks together, you'll generate heat here on Earth. And so they say, well, because we see Enceladus today, we know that at least some objects in the Saturn system must have been evolving really quickly. And if they're evolving really quickly, they must not be that old, or they would have undergone way more change than we see today. And because of this, they suggest that a few hundred million years ago, many of the sort of small and intermediate moons that lie between the main rings of Saturn today and the big outer moon of Titan probably formed out of a large icy ring that is now no longer present. And this kind of just reinforces this really complicated picture that we have at Saturn, where the rings seem to be forming moons, but over larger periods of time, these moons might smack into one another and shatter and go back to forming rings again. And then that new ring would form over a period of hundreds of millions of years its own set of moons. And so that unlike, say, at Jupiter, where we can be relatively certain that the large moons of Jupiter have been in existence for the entire age of the solar system, much of what we see at Saturn today could be just a fleeting glimpse of what has been occurring over the last few billion years.
So looking at Saturn hundreds of millions or billions of years ago, the environment would look totally different. And seeing it again billions of years from now might look different again.
Yeah, that's the implication of this work, and it's an implication that isn't in disagreement with a lot of other work that has been undertaken. Almost everyone, even if you imagine that the rings formed billions of years ago, almost everyone imagines that the moons we see today once originally formed out of the rings. And then it's simply a question of when did that happen, and are we seeing the first cycle of this, or has this been a process that has been renewing itself over the life of the solar system.
So what does 2016 Morgan say about the age of Saturn's rings?
So we sit kind of on a precipice right now because we have a lot of compelling evidence that suggests that the rings must be relatively young. We have compelling evidence that suggests the rings must be relatively old. Fortunately, 2017 Morgan will have hopefully a much more definitive answer about this, because one of the very last observations that Cassini is going to hopefully try and make before plunging into Saturn is to measure the mass of the rings. And it's going to do that by flying between the rings and the planet, as opposed to the last 13 years where we've simply orbited outside of the rings the entire time. And then we'll feel Saturn basically tugging in one direction on the spacecraft and the rings tugging in the other direction on the spacecraft. And that'll change the velocity of the spacecraft a little bit. And we'll hopefully, from Earth, be able to measure that small change in velocity. And that will tell us how much the rings weigh. And the mass of the rings will be the most important piece of evidence we have to determining whether or not the rings are old or young, because all of the observations we have now are basically dependent on how much the rings actually weigh. And that's something we don't really even know within, a factor of 10.
But, I mean, this is one of the great things about science, though, right? Because, you know, I know that we had this conversation in 2015, and you probably would have come on the side of the rings are old. And now you sound like you're kind of in the middle. And now we're going to find out what happens with, as you said, 2017 Morgan. And this is great, right? Like, science just continues to gather the evidence and make its decision based on what seems like, you know, where the most evidence is falling.
Yeah, this is ultimately going to be the legacy of Cassini at Saturn. Just like, I think, with observations of Mercury and the Moon and Mars, we're realizing that the solar system is a far more dynamic place today than we ever had previously imagined. Cassini has revealed that Saturn, sort of a microcosm of this activity, is remarkably more dynamic than we could have possibly imagined even after the Voyager flybys. And it's really shed a whole bunch of new light on the evolution of moon systems around planets, the evolution of planets around the sun, and, you know, when combined with what we've observed with the search for exoplanets, we realize that nothing really is static about the solar system, the local universe, the galaxy, etc.
It's going to be really sad not to have a spacecraft at Saturn after all this time. We got very comfortable to have that spacecraft there, and when we lose it, it's going to really suck.
Yeah, it's almost every week it seems we get some new beautiful picture or result from Saturn. And, you know, after Cassini ends next year, it could be a decade, it could be 3 decades before we get any more results like that.
All right, well, on that note, why don't we wrap things up? So, Brian Koberline, where do people find out more?
You can find me on my website, which is briankoberline.com, and you can find me on Google+, and you can find me at Forbes. So I'm all over the place.
And is there any Patreon goals that people can contribute to make you become their dancing monkey?
Yeah, I haven't gotten to the video things yet, so I got to reach the 500 limit. I'm not there yet.
Oh, I'm ready. I'm ready to help.
Okay.
Kimberly Cartier, where do people find out more?
People can find out more by following me on Twitter at AstroKimCartier, by visiting my website, KimberlyCartier.org. And if you happen to be in the Buffalo, New York area on April 16th, you can come check out my talk at the Buffalo Astronomical Association's annual banquet. So hopefully I will see some of you there.
That's awesome. Morgan, where do people find out more?
Well, you can follow me on Twitter at Morgan Renberg, or visit my website, morganrenberg.com.
I got one last question here that Patrick Festen wants to know, and he's asked a couple of times, which is just the size of the star that we talked about, Brian, the R136A1. How big is it?
There's a picture out that shows them in comparison size to the sun. It's I wouldn't want to guess Orders of magnitude.
I mean, somebody did a video about what the biggest star in the universe is. You might be able to search that up. I know that those supermassive red giant stars reach out beyond, say, the orbit of Saturn, if they were sort of in our solar system, although some of the more massive ones aren't necessarily the biggest ones. It's some of the cooler ones are the bigger ones. And I think I asked a researcher on this, and the largest theoretical size is 2,500 times the size of the sun, which is
frighteningly large.
But it's mostly vacuum.
Yeah, when you get that big, it's all fluffy and fairly cool. Right. So, yeah. Cool. All right, well, so once again, I'm Fritz Kane. You can, if you haven't already, click subscribe on this video, which would be great. Subscribe on the YouTube channel, and that way you'll get a notification of when our show begins. You'd want to go in and modify your notifications to make sure that you get them. A big thanks to Nancy Graziano and the folks from Sophia for joining us this week. What a treat to have us broadcasting live from the hangar, which is just amazing, and getting a chance to see the actual aircraft. More of that, please. That would be great. Cool. So thanks again to everyone for watching. Thanks everyone for participating. Make sure you go to the WSH Crew website and participate in the planning of the show, choosing guests. This is the community that actually makes these shows happen, and you get to be a part of it. And we'd love to have your help and assistance. All right. We'll see you all next week.
Happy Friday.
Happy Friday.